Hello and welcome to Zion's Finest. This is Samuel Sweeten. I'm hosting this week instead of Kenny. I'm here with my friend Vince. How you doing, Vince?
Oh, doing great. Glad to be on the podcast again. And I say again because we tried to do this recording last week unsuccessfully. We had those technical issues. So hopefully we are issue-free today. Looking forward to having this discussion with you again.
I'm looking forward to it as well. Before we jump in, want to run through a few housekeeping items. We have, well, first off, please rate and review the podcast on whatever app you're listening on. Those reviews, those help a lot with getting reach out to lots of different people. Also, join our Slack. We have lots of fun conversations. There's lots of spoilers. Everyone's chatting about it right now. Also, we have the Zion's Finest Invitational coming up in May. That is May 17th, 18th. It's a Saturday in May that ends with a teen. So there's only going to be one of those in May. That everyone should come out to that if you can make it. Also, if you're here in State College, on the 12th, I'm hosting an event here at IGAR Games. So come out to that. All right. I think that's the housekeeping. We've had some crazy spoilers, Vince. What have you thought about everything that's come out in the last week? We got Gideon's troopers. We have Grief and IG-11.
Yeah, there's been a ton of great spoilers out. Some of it has been difficult to evaluate because you haven't seen the full box. But for example, you bring up Gideon, who looked fantastic last week. Looks like he brings some very interesting new mechanics. And then very timely today, we just got the rest of his box with, is it the Death Troopers and Dark Troopers? Is
that what they're called? Yeah, there's a Death Trooper and there's Dark Troopers. I'm struggling to keep track of which is which, but there's the secondary and the support, and I'm not sure which one is which. I'm going to get them mixed up all the time, but they both seem really good. Like, especially those supports. They, 8 health, protection, mobile.
I gotta say, first impressions, I'm not a big fan because it does seem like they're just overstatted.
Yeah.
For a common theme I found for a lot of the most recent spoilers, whether that's Hondo or Gideon or IG, I found that as I read through their cards, I had mixed reactions to their abilities and stats. Some of their abilities, you know, had new mechanics that I was looking forward to exploring. Yeah. But then as I get further into the cards, you would see that they had some specific downsides or drawbacks that made them a little bit more balanced, or you had to consider when you're building your list or trying to play them.
Yeah.
I didn't have that experience with these latest spoilers with the Death Troopers, Death Trooper Escort and Dark Troopers. I'm looking at it right here for their official names. But as I was reading through their cards and their stats, I was like, oh, this is good. This is good too. Oh, this is really good. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they don't have too many new mechanics, but they are just extremely strong stats-wise and ability-wise.
Yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on them too. Someone mentioned in the Slack, they talked about how perhaps their health pool is lower on average because you're going to be using... It's lower than it appears because you're going to be using Moff Gideon's ability to move people around and they're going to be taking some damage from that. And that is true to some extent, but still, they just have good stats all around. Like the defense expertise on the Dark Troopers is really good for a support.
Yeah, it's absurd, the defense expertise. I feel like people complain a lot about Magna Guards right now. Being overstatted, especially as a three-pointer. But my experience with the Magna Guards is that although they're overstatted in a lot of ways, because they're melee only and they only have the single move action on their turn, they can get pretty clunky. Speaking of going back to our main topic for today of dead draws, they can often be a dead draw depending on the situation around them. But then these guys have very similar, if not better, tankiness than the Magna Guards, with 8 health and protection being very similar to 10 health. Their defense expertise, I think, is just a straight-up upgrade to the Magna Guards, right? Yeah, so that's I feel like we're going to be complaining about these guys for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, Empire is seeming like it might take over when they release. I'm personally really excited about Grief and IG-11, and whenever Mando's spoiled, I'm super excited for that just because I love the show, and I think those pieces don't scream near as like crazy stat wise to me. Like, there's some obvious downsides, but some cool things going on too. Like, Grief seems like he has that typical Solo 3 cost figure struggle to get extra mobility. We look at Pawns and Stormtrooper Sergeant. They give mobility to others, but they themselves don't have it.
Yeah, absolutely. And with this heavy spoiler season active right now, it's actually a great time to be talking about what we will be during the main discussion, being this framework for Dead Draws, because it gives a really good analysis for looking at all of these new spoilers and figuring out how they might fit our game plan or the list that we're trying to build with them.
Yeah, let's jump right into it, shall we? We'll talk about dead draws. Can you tell us what is a dead draw? Why do they matter? What does this term even mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Would love to dive into this. So in terms of dead draws, I feel like this is a concept that everyone who's played many Shatterpoint games is kind of aware of. They know un would understand the concept of it, and they think about it a lot in terms of during the gameplay, but nobody's really put a name to it and used it as a specific framework for analysis. So when I'm referring to a dead draw, I'm referring to an activation where you fail to flip an objective out from under your opponent's units. And this is especially important because what I found, at least from my experience playing Shatterpoint and watching Shatterpoint games, is that usually you can't afford to hit two dead draws in one deck
Yeah.
cycle, otherwise you'll lose the struggle. And of course, there's been a lot of discussion around the importance of a struggle, especially struggle one. I'm not sure how much that has changed since the release of Showdown, but before, when it was just shifting priorities, there was a general consensus that struggle one is extremely important. If you lose struggle one, your odds of losing the game are much, much higher.
Yeah.
But does that align with your experience in terms of if you fail to flip an objective twice in one deck cycle, do you find yourself losing the struggle because of
Oh,
that?
100%. And sometimes even once, depending on the draw. Usually, with good play, you can overcome one bad draw, but sometimes you just can't. And two, usually there's just nothing you can do. You just kind of get overwhelmed with the tug of war just pulls so far away from you on that momentum chart that you just end up having to give it up and starting to prep for the next struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. And because you only need two dead draws to often lose you the struggle, it's really important to understand what is likely to be a dead draw in your deck and have plans to really mitigate that. So when it comes to this framework of discussion, draws aren't binary. They're not just dead or alive. Instead, the way I prefer to think about it is on a percentage basis. Now, this percentage basis, these numbers aren't based on stats or math or any sort of calculations. They're more or less just estimates that allow for easy discussion. So a draw can be, say, X percent dead and Y percent live. And that's based on a ton of different factors. Of course, that's based on what the draw is. So which unit are we activating? When is it coming in the order deck? What's the objective you need to flip? How many enemy characters are on there? And a ton of different other factors that dictate the current game state. So to put some examples around this, we can look at some characters that have very low percentage chance of being a dead draw. Someone like
Yeah.
Maul, who I would estimate would only be a dead draw, say 5% of the time. Compare that to a unit like C-3PO, where I would say he's a dead draw maybe 90% of the time. Now, the interesting part of this discussion, and especially as we're in this spoiler season, we can use this framework to look at these new releases. The interesting part is that what are the main characteristics that influence this percentage basis of being a live or a dead draw?
Yeah, I think this is a really fascinating discussion before we jump into these factors that change the math. Like, we've all had that experience when we're playing where we've had the experience while we're playing where we realize, hey, this figure just never performs well on their activation. Like, we talk about pawns and we talk about you talked about C3PO. I haven't had the chance to play with or against 3PO yet, but I could see how be there would be a dead draw frequently, where the more you play with them, you start to feel like, oh, this character never does what I want them to do. Whereas you play with Maul and you're always like, yeah, Maul can do whatever he wants on any turn, and he's never bad to draw or to shatter point. But let's jump into what those factors are that make a character have a higher percentage of being a good draw.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've come up with these six different characteristics that allow us to analyze any single unit. Like you said, this is kind of a feeling or a situation that every experienced Shatterpoint player is familiar with. We've all been in that situation where we're looking to flip the next order card and we're saying, as long as it's not pawns, I have a
Yeah.
chance. Well, why exactly is it that pawns has a higher chance of being a dead draw compared to other units? Well, let's dive into some of these characteristics. The first one here that we're looking at is very simple. It's self-mobility. How far can the unit move themselves, and how many times can they move themselves during their own activation? Of course, going back to the example of someone that is rarely a dead draw with Maul, we can see that he excels in this
Yeah.
category. He has, of course, as with every other unit, the innate move action and advance. And then he can move himself for one force or often, usually for free, just by taking the damage, another full advance. And then taking usually a third advance on the second success of his attack tree.
Yeah.
So oftentimes you have Maul being able to triple advance during his activation. And of course, this is important because Shatterpoint, I mean, with this framework, we're talking about flipping objectives. And realistically, the best way to flip an objective is to get your activating unit onto the objective within contesting range. With Shatterpoint, there's a lot of randomness to it, right? With the activation deck, with the shape of the map, with the priority objective during struggles 2 and 3. So having that mobility, being able to get from point A to point B, no matter where that is extremely important in the unit's probability of flipping that objective.
Yeah, that's 100% true. And it's really once you get to more than one source of extra self-mobility besides your move action that characters really start to shine. Like a character with just an extra dash, that's good extra self-mobility. That's fine. But as soon as you get that second dash, or you get a full advance and a dash, or you can do it twice, that's when you really start to be able to move across the majority of the board.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the standard in my mind is having your regular move action, which so far every single unit has access to, plus an extra dash, usually that you'll have to pay for. I think that's kind of like the baseline. And taking a look at, we talked about how Maul excels at this. 3PO, for example, can only move themselves once with their move action. They don't, to my knowledge, have any access to an additional move during their activation. And that basically prevents them from getting to objectives many of the time in many situations.
Like, I'm really excited about Greef Karga, but as soon as I read his card, I realized he didn't have this. I realized, hey, I'm gonna have to be cognizant of this when I'm playing with him, that he might be a dead draw some of the time because he's just not going to be super mobile and be able to get to that far point.
Yeah, and grief is actually a great transition to the second characteristic because although he cannot move himself an additional time outside of his move action, his first ability allows him to move a bunch of other bounty hunters. No restrictions as long as they're bounty hunter within four, I believe. And I think he was just spoiled 2 days ago, so I'm not super familiar. He has the ability to move all his other allies. So that is characteristic number two. Instead of moving yourself, what is the ability to move other allies? How many times can you do so? How far can you move them? And what are the restrictions to moving those allies? Usually the restrictions that we've seen come in the form of range restrictions. Yeah. Within range three, within range four, timing restrictions. Sometimes you can only do it at the start of activation. Other times, like a tactical network, you can do it anytime during your turn. And then finally, tag restrictions. A lot of times this out of activation movement for allies is restricted to only certain tags, whereas something that is unrestricted is much more powerful because it's just a lot more flexible.
Yeah, like Obi-2. Just, it still has conditions, but you can give anybody a reposition, the right position.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason this is very important and contributes to the probability of being a dead draw is going back to that first point, the easiest way to flip an objective is to get bodies on points. And the more bodies you can move, the more bodies you can threaten with to get onto a point, the better chance you have of flipping an objective, usually without dice being involved at all.
Yeah, it can be really powerful to move a lot of people. We've all had those crazy Kalani turns. I've been playing a lot of Plo recently, and he's felt great at being able to move other people and have high mobility himself. Sometimes it's out of activation, but it's been impressive for me. And we've all seen, like, there are characters like Grief or like Kalani that might have poor self-mobility that you really are trying to take advantage of this part of their character kit in order to score objectives.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting when we're talking about characters like Kalani or Plo, guys that excel at moving allied units. Inherently, I think this is a little bit more, I think we can use the term fragile, than the ability to move yourself very efficiently. And that's because it really depends on the current status of the other units. So when you activate a unit itself, it's never wounded. It can always contest, right? Because if it starts wounded, it flips. And it becomes injured. However, that's not the case when you're moving allies. Kalani, that can move four support characters that are unwounded and can contest, is a completely different Kalani than a Kalani that starts with all the supports wounded on the board, and anyone they move, although they still move and they still attack, they don't offer any contesting presence. The likelihood of that second Kalani being a dead draw is way, way higher than a Kalani in that first situation.
That's very, very true. It's with those, I think the general thought is now out. If you're facing a Kalani, wound his supports quickly.
100%. And I think going back to, you know, why I started thinking about this framework to begin with, it's exactly for situations like that. As a community, we've come up with strategies that already try to maximize the number of dead draws your opponents will get, right? We're trying to minimize the chance that Kalani can flip 2 points at once or even just a single point by wounding his supports. And then it goes back to this analysis of how can we do so and what strategies can we implement to make sure that Kalani has a higher chance of being a dead draw for your opponents.
That kind of brings us to, we have these abilities that, like, oftentimes we talk about wounding people in order to stop these out of activation movements, so to speak. We wound the supports in order to stop Kalani, but that's another aspect of dead draws, is just wounding people helps your ability to wound impacts that percentage of how good of a dead of a draw you are. Sorry, that's kind of unclear. You can explain it better than I.
No. You're making a great point there. So characteristic number three does go back to what you're saying. It does relate to Kalani in many ways as well. The way I would describe this is the ability to turn off enemy contesting through attacks.
Yeah.
So you brought up the one very easy way to turn off contesting, and that's by wounding mm-hmm. them. And then generally speaking, the other way is by displacing yeah. them. So with these attacks, there's pros and cons to both of these categories, whether you're wounding or displacing. Wounding, for example, is usually much dicier. Yeah. It really relies on you rolling well or your opponent rolling poorly so that you can get the wound through. And if you're relying on wounding, then you can actually a lot of times calculate your actual percentage odds of being a dead draw by going through the dice simulator yeah. and then seeing, hey, what are the chances that Darth Vader wounds Rex here, right? Or actually a better example in this case would be, say, Savage, who no matter how good he rolls on his tree, he's never going to displace somebody. Yeah. He has to wound them. So by crunching the dice math on the various dice calculators that are online, you can find out what are the odds that Savage flips this point by wounding Rex or whatever unit it may be on that point. The other side of the coin is displacing. So a couple episodes ago, you had Matt Bronson on talking about the dice math and how we're really looking at, you know, only the first two or three success boxes in the yeah. tree for what's really reliable. So if you see that there is a shove or preferably two shoves amongst those first two or three successes, then you can really say, hey, this guy has pretty good odds of displacing. You can run the same math as for wounding on those dice calculators. But of course, even though it's usually not as dicey as having to wound somebody, there are some inherent drawbacks to just displacement. And that's if the opponent has any out of activation movements for the units you're displacing, that displacement can be easily undone and very quickly as well.
Yeah. I often think if a character doesn't have a shove until the third step, I often think of them as a piece that's in general trying to wound before they try and displace. Because we've all had those. I just plan on only getting 1 to 2 steps on every attack, and then I'm less disappointed in the game in general. But this has been an interest. I've been playing a lot of Plo Vader recently, and this brings this interesting dichotomy of sometimes you're attacking to wound and sometimes you're attacking to push, because you kind of have your Vader side that's more aggro and your Plo side that's more control. And you really have to, when you're deciding whether you're trying to wound or trying to shove, it often depends on who you're attacking as well. If you're attacking a Savage, you probably want to try and wound him because he's just going to hop right back with his expertise if he rolls well enough or the out of activation movement. So you really kind of want different, you want your list to be able to do a little bit of both, to be able to wound, but also to be able to displace through shoves.
Yeah, 100%. And a lot of the best units are just good at yeah. both, where, hey, I only got 2 successes, so now they're displaced. Whereas I high rolled and I got 5 successes, now you're displaced and you're wounded. Yeah. So you get the best of both worlds that way. But of course, with these attacks, they're also tied to, you know, not only the how many dice you're rolling, the quality of expertise, and we touched on the actual attack tree in itself, but a lot of it actually has to tie into point number one, the self-mobility, yeah. right? You have to be able to get into threat range of the unit you're trying to displace or wound in order to affect them. And more importantly, ranged versus melee attacks.
Yeah,
I know there's been a general sentiment in the community that Shatterpoint is very melee focused. I'm not sure I agree with that, because anytime I've played melee only units, I found it to be very inflexible. I really like having the ability to have high mobility combined with potential ranged attacks so that I can affect an objective that is very far away, oftentimes on the other side of the board from where the activating unit starts.
No, that's a good point. That you want to be able to, especially if you're a less mobile unit, you want to have long range so you can affect things from far away. Like someone like Gar, who has medium mobility. I guess mobility is not awful, but it's not incredible either. He has a long range gun and he has shoves at his expertise that allow him to affect points that are far away.
Yeah, and along with the range attacks, it can also tie into the number of attacks you're making. So supports have two chances to make attacks and chances to wound two units or displace two units, which is extremely powerful. And units like Kalani, for example, who they themselves aren't very mobile, so category one, they don't score very highly on, but because they can move friendly allies, and then also use those allies to make long-range attacks, like with a B2 who has a shove on one. Their actual threat range is extremely long, even though they themselves aren't very mobile.
That's a good point. I think threat range is a great way to kind of put in that concept of range versus melee. Because if you're a highly mobile character, then melee attack doesn't having only melee attacks is less of a downside because your threat range is still very high.
Absolutely. And I think this in particular, this characteristic is something that people spend a lot of time on whenever there's a new spoiler. You know, everybody loves to talk about, oh, how much damage can we expect this character to do? What kind of expertise do they have? For myself, I'm always looking, hey, do they have a shove on one? Do they have another shove on two? And do they have crits in their expertise to make that really consistent? This feels like one of the areas that a lot of people focus on. And when it gets away from things that affect contesting, which is wounding and shoves, and then it gets to, you know, conditions in the tree, dashes for the unit that's activating, those become a lot more abstract and much harder to value. Whereas if it's just a shove on one or two, you already know that's very high value
Yeah,
always.
that's 100% true. The having an early, I also value early mobility very highly because it factors into point one, but getting the parsing the value of conditions is always tricky and situation dependent in Shatterpoint.
So the next characteristic is also a big hot topic whenever we're looking at new spoilers and looking at certain characters' power levels. And that is, again, the ability to turn off enemy contesting, but this time instead of through attacks, it's through abilities. You made a mention of Plo Vader. That's seeing a lot of popularity right now. And one of the highlights of that list is frequent use of Force Push, which a lot of people view as one of the strongest abilities in the game. And we see that similarity across many of what we view as the strongest abilities, like Jango Fett's pull and Darth Maul's pull, along with the various Force Pushes. And back when Fifth Brother was a little bit more popular, people liked his Force Repulse quite a bit as well.
We've talked about these a lot. Morgan Reed has his famous rule that he likes to play by of having two units in every list. I think that's a good if you're just starting your Shatterpoint list building adventures, I think that's a good place to start. You learn that that's not always a hard and fast thing that's needed when you're list building, but having at least one source, I feel generally is you want to be able to displace people without having to rely on dice.
Yeah, 100%. And I feel like when we're looking at these abilities through the perspective of dead draws, it's easy to understand why these abilities are valued so highly. And a lot of times these ex abilities are expensive too. So it makes sense why they're valued so highly because they don't depend on dice. A lot of the times when you draw a unit say mole, and you need to displace a single enemy character off the point, you know that for sure you can do it. It is 100% chance live, 0% chance dead, because you don't have to be rolling any dice. And then, of course, these abilities stack with characteristic number three, being able to turn off enemy contesting with attacks, because Maul, for example, can often turn off two enemy units off of one point, one by pulling them off, and then the other by either displacing them or wounding them with his attack. But of course, once you're talking about rolling dice, then you have to factor that in to the probability that he's actually going to be successful in doing so.
That's a common play I've been doing with Plo is he takes his Vader damage, he attacks one person, shoves that person, and force pushes the second person on.
Absolutely. And speaking of Plo, combining that with Vader, that's super strong because Vader's buff allows him to hit that ability for free often. And that's a great transition to characteristic number five, which is oftentimes very tied to what we talked about with number four, these abilities that turn off enemy contesting. And that's force reliance. How much force does that unit require to accomplish and maximize the characteristics we talked about from number one to number four? For someone like Darth Maul, for example, a common talking point about why he's so powerful is because he frees up the force usage for the rest of the team. He himself doesn't need to use any of the force. And so even when you draw him and you have no force remaining, as long as he's got some health, he can perform at his maximum potential and he's not hindered. Someone that is more force intensive, for example, where let's say it's Plo or Barriss, where normally if you had two force for the force push, you draw them, you might know, hey, this guy is 100% chance of being alive because I just need to push this one enemy unit off. If you don't have that force, those percentages are no longer 100%. Now you got to try and hit it off of your force tree, off of your attack tree, or just do some regular dice-based displacement. And so that has a huge impact on whether the draw is live or dead.
And importantly for me, I feel like characters with a good force economy increase the live draw of all the other units in your list. So Maul makes everyone else more active because they can spend force abilities. People with good force refresh abilities, like Mace to some extent, does this in Republic lists, that like he's a force refresh battery. He's making your other units be able to spend force for the extra mobility for their displacement that allows them to be live a higher percentage of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a fantastic point. There's a lot of synergy when it comes to looking at a list, and you really want things that help maximize the probability that ally draws will be live draws instead of dead draws. So the last characteristic here, this is probably the most broad and general, but it's a very important point that's worth touching on, and this is resistance to enemy control effects. Now, like I said, it's not the best descriptor, but if we put some examples to it, I think we can all relate to these types of effects. Things like Mind Trick from OB2 are one of the strongest examples of this type of effect. There are tons of different units ranging in power level that if you have an OB2 on a point, an opponent's OB2 on a point with access to two force, they can completely shut down your ability to be a live draw. A lot of the times, if you flip a unit, you have an OB2 across from you, you know that unit will not be able to flip that point purely because of his ability to mind trick you.
The Dark Troopers kind of shut down a different point, whereas OB2 shuts down attack displacement that makes someone's dead draw. The Dark Troopers shut down your guaranteed displacement. That's another control point, or Dooku's counter, or Luke's jump and recover after an attack. These are all abilities to resist being removed.
Yeah, 100%. And that's what I mean when I want to say this is a very broad category, because tons of things can fall into this category, even things that are simple like conditions. And this is actually, we're fresh off of the spoiler of IG something. I don't actually know his numbers. IG11, it looks like. But he is another single body support unit. He is the third to be released alongside the Inquisitors from early last year. But I feel like one of the issues with these single body support units is relates to this last point here in particular, especially with conditions. So a single body support unit, if they are pinned or disarmed, their activation is much more neutered compared to a double body support unit. Because I'm sure we've all found when we activate a support, we see that they're pinned. A lot of the times there is a waste move that we can use to clear the pin. So one character doesn't actually need to move, and then the other character can still move unencumbered, and your turn is not affected very much. The probability that that unit is able to flip a point basically stays the same. Same kind of concept with a disarm, where you can have a waste attack to clear the disarm and then make that one attack into what you actually need to hit. But of course, that's not the case with supports, single body supports.
I actually, when looking at IG-11 and having this framing in mind that they can, that single body supports can be really vulnerable to conditions that shut them down, I was really happy to see two things that I think help mitigate that for him. One, he just removes a condition at the start of his turn with his tactics. And
Yeah, I knew exactly where you're going
two,
with
he gets
this.
to make two attacks. So if he's pinned and disarmed, he just removes his pin. And his first attack, you attack your less important target. And then your second attack, you attack a different target and you can remove a momentum if you really need those extra dice.
Absolutely. And I'm glad we're on the same page there, because I feel like IG in particular uniquely addresses these concerns, whereas the previous single body supports with fifth brother, fourth sister have this weakness. It was pretty refreshing to see that IG won't have these weaknesses.
Yeah, I was glad to see that as well. This reminds me of a game I just played with Curtis, one of our Slack members, a member of the Utah community. We played on TTS, and he was playing Vader Plo against a bounty hunter list that he had brought Leia Bush in, and I got a strain, a pin, and a disarm on Boosh. And he spent most of the game, she just sat in reserve doing nothing because she was a dead draw just because she had three conditions on her that she had three health left, was strained, pinned, disarmed. Literally couldn't do anything. And that cut off his ability to do anything with his reserve because he just had to have Leia sit there doing nothing. So the ability to mitigate conditions is an ability to resist becoming a dead draw.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the other ability that falls into this category are counterattack effects, like Mother Talzin, Dooku, Chirpa, who's recently been released. And we see that it's a very interesting dynamic that plays off of the other characteristics that we talked about. For example, you may be tempted to use the Vader buff to increase the chances that you can displace or wound someone with an attack. But if you have a Mother Talzin across the board from you, that's going to be in range to shoot you back after you wound. Because you use the Vader buff, you've increased your chances that you are able to flip the point. But at the same time, the drawback is that you've also increased the chances that Mother Talzin will wound your unit on her shot back.
Yeah, and this ties into something that you brought up last time we talked about this, that pairing these abilities together can really bring out unique synergies. Like you talked about Vader Talzin, that you have this cost where you become easier to wound, you be easier to become a dead draw when you take this damage, but you're counteracting that by having these counterattacks from Talzin on your team.
Absolutely. And it also ties into what you were just talking about with the reserve slot, how in the game you were just talking about, Boosh was stuck in reserve because she was going to be a dead draw as she was loaded up on conditions. Yeah. And so a lot of the times we find ourselves looking to use that reserve slot for a dead draw until their probability to flip an objective becomes higher later on in the game. So in the list that I've been running recently, which is Vader Talzin, Vader with Rex and Arfs, Talzin with Sabi and Handmaidens, a little bit of a janky squad, but I've been liking it so far. What I find is that
I think it's pretty sweet.
Early on, yeah, I've been loving it. I've been loving it. So no complaints on my side. But one of the reasons I've been loving it is because everybody feels like a very live draw, except for Talzin early game. But because she's the only one that has a high probability of being a dead draw, I can reserve that reserve slot exclusively for her until she has better probability of flipping a point, which realistically means after one of my units has been wounded, she gets a dash up, which allows her to get full coverage of midline objectives on her activation, allows her to walk on to the midline objectives. Lots of weaknesses going back to those characteristics that she initially would have during her activation, which get mitigated by her identity.
Yeah, I think that's a sweet list. I've been splashing Sabe and Handmaidens into more stuff when you've talked about that. I really liked having Sabe with Vader because Vader's biggest weakness that can make him a dead draw is that he is a single unit that does not move anybody else. So he has trouble when he has to contest a point that has two or more different units on it. And having Sabe with coordinated fire dash really can change that math. So I've really liked having Sabe with Vader. It ties into those comics. They make a good duo in the comics. So the thematic win there.
Right, right. No, absolutely. And Sabe is pretty unique in that front because she gives that ability to any Galactic Republic ally. Yeah. Right, she basically allows any of those allies to be able to move somebody else, being herself, out of activation. I found the same for Rex, although it's quite a bit more limited with Rex. Yeah. With I'm Always First Kid, my ARFs have been having a much higher probability of flipping a point when I'm Always First Kid. Not just because Rex can make an additional attack, which of course increases the chances I wound or displace somebody off of a point, but because he often himself is dashing onto the point as well, meaning there's three bodies moving on the ARF's activations. This does go back to something we discussed when we were talking about Kalani and moving allies out of activation, and that's that your opponent will largely look to mitigate that by keeping your allies wounded, your units wounded, whether that's supports when you're playing against droids, or maybe when you're playing against Sabe, you want to keep Sabe wounded so that she's not dashing and contesting objectives during her allies' activations. So one really unique thing with Talzin and in my list is that when my opponents decrease the probability other units can flip a point by wounding their allies. So let's say they wound the ARFs so that Rex has one less unit to dash during his activation. They only increase the probability that Talzin is able to flip points. Going back to why I was saying I reserve her early on.
Yeah, I really like that. I really like Talzin for that reason. She always feels great to play because you're punishing your opponent for their usually good plays that are like, I'm going to make your draws more dead, but it's a trade-off. You're just giving the Talzin player more to work with their Talzin activation. So it's a really interesting conundrum. I've found many times I've been I've really enjoyed playing Talzin, and I've been doing. Plo does a similar but different thing. So I've been playing lots of him. That when people target one of your other units, Plo getting to dash is a big deal. That just that extra movement makes it easier for Plo to be a live draw.
Right. And oftentimes it can, prevent your opponent's activating unit from being a live draw, because when they displace a wound, one thing, Plo comes in and takes their spot.
It's been important for me in my games with him. When I played Talzin, that's often been important. Last time I played against Talzin, actually, this is a bad beat story on my end that shows the power of these types of things for Talzin. It was a struggle three. I was playing an Ahra list, trying to make Ahra work, which I'll touch on her in just a
Nice.
little bit of how she fails in a lot of these categories. I was trying to make Ahra work, and I had some ARFs. I could give her the Galactic Republic tag maybe and get an expose sometimes if I needed to. The list didn't really pan out. Anyways, the ARFs were, I needed them to go to two different points, and they needed to, there was a character with one health left. I think it was some Mando Super Commandos. And I needed them to wound the Super Commandos and split up onto these two different points. And then I have this huge swing where I control all 3 points in the third struggle. And if not, I don't flip anything. So I wound them. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do this. It's going to be sweet. And Talzin comes along. Talzin's wounded. So I know that Talzin moving on to the point's not going to do anything. My ARFs are at full health. And she just one-shots them with a five dice attack. And my activation immediately ended, and it was a dead draw that cost me the game because they shut down my ability to be live in the middle of my turn. It was brutal.
That's the classic Talzin activation there, or clapback in that case. But I think you bring up a very interesting point with that example, in that if the turn went your way, you would flip all 3 points, and if it doesn't, you don't flip any. And that's something that can also be discussed and should be discussed within this framework, but doesn't fit neatly into any of these categories. When we're talking about the probability of being a live or dead draw, there's some units that have a much higher ceiling but a much lower floor. The scenario you described is a great one, but I think a unit that often fits this type of high ceiling but low floor is Luminara, where her identity lets you move somebody as long as you wound. But of course, like we're talking about, wounding is often very dicey. So you've got these situations where you flip a card and you're like, hey, with my Lumi leadership, if I get the right dice, I'm going to flip 4 points and basically win the struggle. But if I don't get the right dice, I don't flip anything, and I probably lose the struggle. So I'm not sure how to account for that in this framework in particular, but it's definitely something that's worth keeping in mind and discussing in any specific situation.
Yeah, I think Lumi is a great example that she makes a lot of other draws live if they can wound, but her activations are usually pretty poor. Like she has to spend a force for a dash. We know that that's like on par, but then she's a melee only unit with mediocre attacks. So she can end up not feeling like she does much at all on her turn when she's. And her ability to move other units is dependent on where they are in your order deck, which she does have some more control over because of her identity, but that can also be finicky. She's a very tricky unit that can pull off some of the craziest plays in Shatterpoint, but can also do very little, which is why I think the opinions on her are so varied. And why I've kind of ended up in a middle ground on her, where I think she's good. I used to think she was awful, and I'm not at the she's great, but I'm like, she's good. She has her lists that perform really well, and a player who's really experienced with her can get a lot of value.
For sure. And oftentimes the discussion with Lumi is the drawback of her own activation, like you mentioned. And it's really easy to understand why through this framework, right? Because she is a primary that is melee only, she has, I guess we could say, average mobility because she has her own move action and a dash she can pay for. The issue with her being a live draw is that innately, she doesn't get full coverage of the midline scenarios, the midnight objective points. If an opponent is standing just a little further back, still contesting the midline point, she can't even attack it, even if there's no terrain in the way. And of course, looking at that framework, you have to be able to get there. You usually want to be able to attack the unit that you're trying to flip the point out from under from. And so that really highlights why she often is a dead draw. And at the same time, in Gar, you have a lot of ways to dash her out of activation, like with a Rex or with Ahsoka, Padawan Ahsoka. And again, looking through the framework, we can understand how we can minimize her probability of it being a dead draw, going back to those characteristics.
I want to talk about Ahra real briefly, because Ahra was a unit that I've been trying to make work, and other people have had some success with her, they've been saying in the Slack, but I have really struggled to make her shine. There's a lot of struggles that I've had with her, but one, when I go down these lists, I think she struggles on a lot of these. She does have some decent self-mobility. If she makes a combat action and pays for hit and run, she gets a reposition, which is good. She does not move anybody else, though. She's just the one body. Ability to remove enemy characters through attacks is pretty low. She does not have a shove until step three. Her damage isn't crazy unless you spike her tree. And though, well, she can get extra dice, it is pretty costly.
Yeah, hard to set up. And the big issue that I found in my experience with Aura is that her expertise is
Yeah, it's real
terrible.
bad.
So even though she rolls buckets of dice, like those dice don't really convert very well. And with the shoves being, at first when I played her, I thought that shove was on two because it's like diagonally across from the first slot. So I misread it. I'm like, okay, she's pretty good. When it was pointed out to me that it was on three and four, I'm like, okay, that really lowers her effectiveness and that probability that she's able to flip some points.
Yeah, like that's just real rough. Like her offensive expertise is just awful. She's rolling all this dice and still sometimes just gets only two steps. She doesn't have guaranteed displacement, which most characters don't, to be fair. She's oddly kind of force hungry because you want to give her some extra mobility through pay what's that? The bounty hunter thing where it changes her tags, but that's often also a trap. It's a weird ability. And she has decent defense expertise, but nothing that keeps her on points. And she can just, she can get shoved off pretty easy. Eight health is pretty average. She just doesn't excel at any one of these points and can often just be a dead draw because of that.
Yeah, and when you look at her in a vacuum, you may say, hey, she's got decent mobility herself. Maybe I can try and roll lucky and get those shoves on three and four. And she might look okay, but it's really when you look at her in comparison to other A tier, S tier secondaries that you see that stark contrast. Because those A tier, S tier secondaries, like Rex, like Kraken, like Sabe, usually they excel in every single one of these categories, basically, or maybe like five of the six categories.
Or like Jango does five of six. He just doesn't do mobility for other units, right? He's really highly mobile if you need him to be. He can jump twice. He has guaranteed displacement. But
I think the other category he might struggle with is being able to turn off enemy contesting through attacks.
yeah.
From what I remember, he doesn't push that well. I think maybe it's on three
No,
or four as
he doesn't
well
push that well.
with.
He does have good expertise and decent damage output.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think he also has his shove isn't till like three or something. So it's but it's an intro. I really like this framework. It's changed how I've thought about list building. What has it done for? Well, I guess we've talked a lot about list building here. Let's jump to how do we mitigate dead draws? Because they come up. We're all going to have that experience where we're like, oh man, this character is bad. But I need to go with them. How do we mitigate that activation? It's going to be a dead draw.
Yeah, 100%. One major thing, I think, is considering the use of your reserve space. And really, you would, when you're in any situation where you're considering reserving a unit, you want to consider what else is remaining in your deck and the probability of those units flipping an objective compared to the unit that you're about to reserve or you're considering reserving. And I think this is like a calculation that basically every Shatterpoint player has made in their games, where they're thinking, what else do I have in my deck? Is it going to be better than, say, pawns? Yeah. Usually with its pawns, sure, a lot of times it may be. But then taking it a step further, eventually you're going to have to activate pawns. And you want to think about which situation will I come up into where pawns has a good probability of flipping an objective. And that's really when I want to activate them.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to frame it. And I think sometimes you're going to have to realize that you're going to have to, that biting the bullet now, and sometimes you're going to say like, hey, I could activate pawns right now and it's not going to be great. But if I have to activate them 3 turns from now, it's going to be even worse. So I'm just going to bite the bullet now, get this bad activation over with, and that keeps you. And if you have two of those, as I said, you've probably lost the struggle, but you can get away with one of those if you have the right setup. You say like, hey, I can afford it right now. Let's take this bad activation that'll get me set up to have more powerful activations on all my future turns. And sometimes that's the decision to make. Just, we're going to do the best we can. It's not great, but it's going to help me in the long run.
Absolutely. And then aside from the reserves, I think this can influence the matchups we're trying to pick for our individual units. One of the easiest examples is, say, you're running Savage and your opponent is running OB2. You really don't want Savage on the same side as OB2, because when we look at Savage going through these characteristics, we can see that OB2 completely shuts down his ability to flip an objective because of some of the limitations he has within these characteristics.
Yeah, OB2 just makes Savage, really the only thing Savage can do to shut down people is remove enemy characters through attacks, and he's decently mobile. And OB2 just says, nope, you're no longer attacking, and so you just have to rely on Savage moving somewhere and hoping that his body counts as enough. So in deployment, you want to set up your Savage far away, or if you're playing Premier, just leave your Savage for another matchup when you're playing against an OB2 list.
Absolutely. And then the other factor here, I think, in terms of how it influences your gameplay is trying to set up your other characters to be better live draws when they come up. So things like using Rex's dash on Luminara, where by looking at these characteristics, we understand that Luminara innately has a very dead draw with her first activation in most of the circumstances. And by giving her that one extra dash, we can really minimize the probability of her being a dead draw by a large percentage a lot of the times.
So Vince, before we close out, what is a unit that you find is dead more often than you would think? And what's a unit that you think is more alive more often than you would think?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And of course, I can only answer from my limited perspective. I don't play everything in the game at this point in time. But one reason I built my current Vader Talzin list is because I found that the players I'm playing against are getting better and better at making the draws dead in my Maul Grievous list. And that's just Maul Grievous with all droids. Initially, I found that all the draws were always live all the time, basically, more or less. But there's been some unique strategies that people have been starting to implement and recognize that really mitigate the effectiveness and the probability that these units can flip points. One thing that we talked about earlier is that versus Kalani, Kraken, Grievous, if you keep the supports wounded all the time and prioritize that, their chances of flipping a point go way down because they're not moving three or four contesting bodies at once in their activation. But that seems like that's something that the general community has already recognized and has implemented into their games against droids. One thing that I feel people don't do enough is counterplay versus Maul specifically. And if anybody does this to me playing Maul during the league play, I'll be very upset. So please don't do this. But the best way to minimize Maul's chance of being a live draw is by not killing him, not wounding him, and instead just putting as much damage on him as possible, right before he gets wounded, and riddling him with conditions. So my main gaming partner has gotten very good at doing this. And so I feel like I haven't adapted my playstyle well enough for it because when I'm playing a Maul list, I am very aggressively spending all my force, not really keeping any force budget for Maul because usually he doesn't use any force, he just uses his health. But I've been stuck in a couple of situations then where my opponent hasn't wounded Maul. He has, 9 or 10 damage on him and he's pinned and disarmed. And then I look at my force and I've used all my force on my droids already. Now, Maul, who is usually 95% chance a live draw, now is 95% chance a dead draw, or rough numbers speaking. And I feel like that is a general tactic that hasn't been widely adopted, even though we're seeing a ton of Maul in the meta.
No, I think loading people up with conditions and keeping them a couple of health away is from being wounded is a great way to deny activations. I think when Grief comes out, we're going to see some bounty hunter lists that are set up to try and do exactly that, where they just leave a bunch of people highly damaged, and then there you have Jango trying to pin people, and if they're in reserve, Grief's going to get an extra attack on them. So not only are they being hurt by conditions and being almost dead, they might just end the activation, might just be it.
Combine that with not so fast. That's the ultimate dead draw, right? When you get not so fasted and your unit doesn't even get to activate at all.
That is the ultimate version of that. What about a unit who you find is live more often than you think?
This again, it goes back to my experience playing against my primary gaming partner. He plays Gar a lot, and he's really shown me the ability for Rex to assist and make the clone supports much better at being a live draw than they would be innately, just because of that third attack, with amazing expertise, an attack that is, does either four damage on two successes or two shoves on two successes, and then him being able to move on top of that. So I've been using that a lot with my Arse in this Vader Talzin list. And I've actually oddly found that I've shatter pointed the Arfs a couple of times because they're so effective at getting three attacks and three bodies moving on their activation. So doesn't need to be said. Everybody knows that Rex is an all-star, but he's been overperforming for me, not just in his own activation, but particularly during the Arfs activation.
No, that's awesome. I think for me, a unit who I play that I'm surprised by how often they're live are B1s. Like, I'm not saying that they're live all the time, but that they are more they are live more often than I think, largely because of their early reposition and the fact that they just passively can give out expose that can help set up their turns.
It's been a little while since I've played the B1s. They have a shove on two, is that right?
No, they don't. B1s,
Okay.
they have a reposition on two.
Oh, yes. Okay. No, that makes sense. Yeah, they don't shove very well at all. I haven't played them since I've been playing the B2s basically when they
Yeah.
came out shortly after the
So I
B1s were
look at them and
released.
they have a lot of weaknesses, right? I'm not saying that they're like an always active unit, but they are more active often than I think, because they're often you play them in an all droids list, and then if you're playing like a Dooku Grievous is an example, you play them with Kalani and you have lots of droids attacking and you get off a passive expose on someone, and then when they attack into someone, you're getting decently far on their tree because they just roll a lot of dice, so expose is valuable for that. And then all of a sudden they're all over the board. And I often, and I don't expect them to always be, because I think, oh, I have my one move with them. So that's someone who surprises me, that I often, when I build a list with B1s, I think they're going to be, they have the highest odds of being the dead draw on the list. They're just more active more often than I think.
Yeah, and I think that surprise factor is definitely something that's very interesting to talk about because when we talked about this live and dead draw, we talked about probabilities, but also I think another thought that a lot of us are familiar with is that when we're looking at what's remaining in the opponent's
Yeah.
order deck, we're not only assessing how live those draws are, but which objectives they can actually threaten. So a lot of the times, especially on say Showdown, where you often have two different flanks, you can see, hey, my right side is threatened by the remaining cards in their order deck, but my left side is safe. But some of these surprise activations, like the B1s, for example, could really throw off that calculation and take your opponent for
And
surprise.
I think someone in the opposite way that I've been a little surprised by how sometimes they can be dead is Mace. When I play a Mace
Ah.
activation that like sometimes he just like he gives some good out of activation movement, and he has his he's good at helping with your force economy, which are important things in a list. But sometimes Mace's own activation, if he's in that Jedi Master stance where he's giving you force, like sometimes he just doesn't have the mobility to get where he needs to be, or he if you use a coordinated fire and you can't use his rerolls, he doesn't always climb his tree well enough to get the result that you needed. And sometimes, not saying that he's often dead, but he's just m more dead than I expected when first playing him.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's a common theme with a lot of the Galactic Republic primaries that have average speed and melee-only attacks. You can find them in a lot of sticky situations where the probability to flip a point is not very good. And so, of course, that goes back into other list building and gameplay that can try to mitigate that as best as possible.
Yeah, and I want to be clear that I'm not saying that B1s are world enders or that Mace is a bad unit. That just these are things that have surprised me with them. Well, thank you, Vince. I had a blast talking about this again, and it's really changed kind of how I thinking about it more has changed more of how I build lists and how I think about when I'm playing a game of Shatterpoint. Okay, I'm paying attention to how often a unit feels like a dead or live draw and making changes on my lists based on that.
Awesome. It was a pleasure to be on the podcast. I'm honored to be a guest here. I'm a big fan of your content. You guys do some great competitive focused discussions on Shatterpoint, which I think we could keep using more of. And I'm glad that this framework has been useful for a lot of people. I look forward as we're entering right into spoiler season here to continue to analyze a lot of these units through this framework.
Yeah, I'm excited for it too. Before we head off, is there anyone you want to shout out?
No, I don't create much content regularly, but you can find me on the Discords pretty actively. Always happy to chat about Shatterpoint. Always happy to get a TTS game in as well. So hit me up anytime. I'm Vince Chan MCP on Discord. But if I play some more Shatterpoint, I should probably change that to Vince Chan SP eventually in the
Yeah.
future.
Well, thanks, Vince. It's been great to chat, and thanks to you all for listening. Have a good one.